AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. President Biden tonight saying he's confident Congress on Wednesday will pass the debt ceiling deal and avoid a potential default. Could happen a week from today.
There is no reason why it shouldn't get done by the 5th. I'm confident that we'll get a vote in both houses, and we'll see.
Some Republicans telling ABC News they're leaning toward voting against the bill. Others say they're a definite no. After laying a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, President Biden told veterans and families his late son, Beau, was proud to volunteer in the National Guard. Beau Biden served in the Iraq War. An investigation at the partially collapsed six-story apartment complex in Davenport, Iowa. Linnea Hoover was in one of the units when others crashed to the ground.
All these people are running, they're screaming, people are telling us to get out, and you look over and it's all gone. Like, it didn't register that it was gone.
This is ABC News. Venice, Italy's famous Grand Canal mysteriously turned bright green over the weekend.
Police in Italy are investigating after a chunk of Venice's famous Grand Canal turned fluorescent green over the weekend. Regional officials say they are also testing the green water and working to identify the substance that changed the water's color. Some suspect environmental groups who have been coloring monuments in recent weeks, for instance, using vegetable charcoal to turn the waters of Rome's Trevi Fountain black. Inez de la Quatera, ABC News. At the Foreign Desk.
A teenager who just months ago survived a wrong house shooting joined a Memorial Day walk and run event in Overland Park, Kansas. Ralph Jarl helped raise money for traumatic brain injuries. His mom, Cleo Nagby, spoke to several hundred there, talked about her son's gunshot wound recovery.
There are emotional ups and downs. You have the concentration problems. You have the, I want to stay in my room all day. You have all of that.
Andy Field, ABC News.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Nattner. Here's what you need to know. The Wisconsin Realtors Association says existing home sales in April down 32.5% compared to last year, so it's still a seller's market. The Milwaukee, Madison, and Green Bay areas all saw home sales drop 31 to 36% in April of this year. It's even worse for homes considered more affordable for first-time buyers. The association says there are 1.7 months of inventory in the $125,000 to $200,000 range and 2 months of inventory in the $200,000 to $350,000 range. This winter, the Great Lakes saw the fourth lowest ice cover since scientists began keeping track a half century ago. Data from NOAA shows the average ice cover was only 6.2% this year. The average over the last 50 years, 24.5%. I'm Jane Mattner. This is Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999. And again, 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats. And there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger. Featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown.
Monday mornings at 8 on WISS and WGBW and on the Civic Media app.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
And we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to spend a little time looking back over a couple of interviews that we've done in the past couple of months. I hope everyone had a safe, enjoyable, memorable Memorial Day weekend. It is about those people who have sacrificed their lives for our country. And look, you know, given all the things that have happened over the last several days, I think, you know, this weekend really kind of something to be taken into the heart and thought about. As we move forward with our discussions on what needs to be done. And this is where, seriously, the idea of we the people standing up and speaking out, especially when you start talking about overwhelmingly the direction of policy and the way it should be going, what we the people want and what our politicians are doing, very different things. And I'm going to spend a little time today, you know, talking about a couple of things. You know, in the first half hour here, we're going to talk with Hayden Wright. Her and her husband have been on strike for over a year at Warrior Met Coal in Alabama. And again, this is another one of those stories of workers struggling, of workers making sacrifices to bail out a corporation, and then that corporation turning around and saying, well, you know, we got ours. Tough luck on you. And those workers fight to just have dignity and respect and a system that's really rigged against them. And we're going to talk to her in the first half hour. Second half hour of the first hour, we're going to talk with Ian Millhiser, you know, one of my go-to Supreme Court guys, about what's going on with the abortion rights issue and really the direction of the court going really in a very, very, really bad direction for working people. And this is one of these moments where I talk about often. Politicians are the tools to get what we need. It's up to us to demand better from them on every front, on all of our rights. You know, I say this a lot. I wish we as working people would take our rights to collectively bargain, our rights to privacy, our rights to our body, our rights to a whole bunch of things, as seriously as my NRA friends take their NRA membership. You know, I say it myself, you know, you'll pry my union card from my cold dead hand, just like my NRA friends. The difference is I want to make people's lives better. And this is one of these weird kind of moments where we're in. I'm not a gun grabber, but there's got to be some sane regulation and some sane way forward. I look at other countries that have, you know, gun cultures. they don't have these problems. And, you know, but the difference is there's some sanity. It's ridiculous to me that we have this kind of laissez-faire attitude that says, no, we're going to have whatever you want, wherever you want, however you want, and no real controls. And my friends love to make comparisons to you know, cars kill people too. You go, yeah, but but we regulate them. We train people to use them better. We insure them. There's a lot of things we do. And if you're really bad at that, if you're really bad at any of those, we take that away. We restrict that in a way that you're not a danger to everyone else. That seems rational. But again, it comes back to us on all of these fronts. So today I want to spend a little time looking back at a couple of interviews we did. Like I said, I think these are important ones. On all these fronts, on the workers' rights fronts, on the privacy front. I would love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do appreciate the input. I do appreciate, you know, folks chiming in and sharing some thoughts, because, you know, we're in a really tough moment right now. We are so divided. I think these are the kind of things where we stand together on these issues. This is the stuff that could pull us together. The kind of common sense, logical, sensible reforms that could pull us together, saying, yeah, we do stand for workers' rights. We do stand for women's rights. We stand for life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine? Can you imagine if we did that? I'm gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Hayden Wright's going to be here. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, it's been over a year. Look, I can't believe that. It's been over a year since some 1,100 coal miners in Alabama put down their tools and picked up a picket sign and took to the picket line. April 1st, 2021, 1,100 miners, members of the United Mine Workers of America, frustrated, angry over the fact that their employer, United Warrior Met Coal, were unwilling to live up to their promises and negotiate a fair contract, did the only thing workers can ultimately do, and that was put down their tools, fold their arms, and march in the streets and go on strike. And here to talk about what the last year has been like and what the future holds, I've asked Hayden Wright to come talk with us. Her husband, Braxton Wright, is a control room operator at Warrior Met Coal. He's also a UMWA committee man. Hayden is a member of, he's the UMWA auxiliary president for Locals 2245 and 2368. Hayden, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me back on the show. I enjoyed being here talking to you last time, so I'm excited to be back talking to you as we pass the year mark.
I got to tell you, I love having you on. I love talking to you. I'm sad that we're here. Over a year, I had hoped that wouldn't get to this.
Everyone's actually dug in. At this point, you know, you've dug in your trenches and you're like, I'm not accepting less than what I deserve. And when you think about, you've been on strike for over a year, we've had less than 15% of the workforce that was there at the mines cross. And that's in over a year. So that's pretty incredible to think about. And it's only been with the support of you and people like you that have gotten the story out, that have led to having the encouragement that we need to stand strong for this long.
No, ultimately, it comes down to the concept of one day longer, one day stronger. If any of us have a chance, which is why I'm hoping that folks are are helping support you, helping your fundraisers, doing what we can to help make you get you through this rough time, because this can't be easy on your family. This can't be easy on the families. These 1,100 families that depended on this company for their livelihoods and made this company profitable and brought this company back from the brink of bankruptcy and all of the promises that they made and the sacrifices that these workers made so this company could return to profitability, only to be told, sorry, you're on your own.
Right. When anytime you go on strike as a last resort. You go on strike when a company refuses to negotiate in good faith with workers and with the union. So that's what happened here. And none of us thought that we would be on strike for now past a year. And it has been incredible. And it's a beautiful thing to see mutual aid and solidarity in action. Because while we as a UNW membership have stood strong, we've been holding the line. It's been other unions coming in and lifting us up, offering aid and support. And not just other unions or union members, just workers across the country that are like, we support you and we love and we care about you. That's incredible. Back in December, when we did the Solidarity Santa for families, we had over 300 children that received Christmas gifts that were given by people across the country who didn't know them, that didn't know us, but knew that we were fighting not only for fair compensation for ourselves, but for them. So that way, these companies will see that they can't keep exploiting workers this way.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. Now, yesterday, I understand you guys had a big rally, 3,500 people in attendance. The message out of that is, I think, you know, as you just said, that, you know, the community is behind you, workers are behind you, and this is still a front and center in a lot of people's minds.
Definitely, and there was numerous, you know, UMWA locals represented that came down on buses from all over to be there in solidarity with all of us and lift us up and let us know that we are not alone. And I think that is the big thing with the UMWA, and it is within the labor movement in general, that we are one and we are everywhere. We take that seriously. When RWDSU is organizing in Bessemer and they've had rallies, we've gone there to support them. And yesterday when we were rallying, guess who was there to support us? They were. You not here. A ton of, you know, the AFL-CIO unions were all there. The Teamsters had sent people, steel workers. So it was a beautiful thing when you see people that say, it doesn't matter what your industry is. It doesn't matter that we're not in the same field. What matters is we're all workers and all of our work is valuable and you deserve to be treated fairly. And that is something that if you haven't experienced that, it's hard to explain to people what that feels like to be there in that situation.
No, that sense of solidarity, that sense of you know, the old labor adage, you know, an injury to one being an injury to all, and truly internalizing that and walking the walk while talking the talk. It's I've been there and I understand it. And UMWA does it as well as anyone. You know, I remember being part of some of the marches and some of the rallies that they had done around the health care for minors, you know, a number of years back in Charleston and Fairmont, West Virginia. And you know, just. You know, the kind of solidarity that your members understand. So in this moment, where are you guys with bargaining? Where are you guys? Is the company talking? Are there negotiations going on? Is there a path forward? I'm curious where things are now.
There are ongoing negotiations. Again, the UMWA, the membership, are ready to get back to work. Those are union minds. They've been union minds for 100 years. And they're going to stay union minds. But when you're looking at comparable minds in the area, because you have, you know, UMWA Shoal Creek and UMWA locals at Oak Grove, that their contracts far, far exceed what we were offered, we're not willing to take that. When what people also need to realize is we're just fighting to get back what we gave up to save this company from closing down, to save them from bankruptcy. So you're talking about pay cuts over $6 an hour. You're talking about losing 100% health care coverage and going to an 80-20 plan with the $720 deductible per person. You're talking about losing incentive pay like double time and triple time. You're talking about instead of working 5 days a week, you're working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. You never saw your families. Even the only holidays you had physically off were Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve, and Christmas Day. The rest of the time, the company told you when you could take off for that holiday so you could eat cold barbecue alone. So after 5 years of that, it was pretty easy, I think, for us to say we've had enough.
Yeah, now it's interesting, you know, just the other day, you had brought up Amazon here a second ago. Jim Cramer, the TV commentator, said that, you know, Amazon's in huge trouble because, you know, when the union gets in here, they talk, it's all about the union and their work rules. And it was his view that when the company Amazon is successful because they're able to tell employees when they're going to work, and it's all about them. And I'm hearing what you're saying. The world that the Jim Cramers want are what your husband and what the members have been suffering for the last several years, working 7 days a week, 12-hour days, basically, you know, in horrible conditions with the union, and the union saying enough of this. And I 100% support that.
Right. And yeah, I saw that clip from him. I actually shared it and I was like, wait, did he actually mean to tell everybody why they need a union? Because literally you just listed off all the ways that you're exploiting workers and how if they can't force you to work when they say, for however long they say, that it hurts the company. So I'm like, you really just gave a poster ad for exactly why you need a union? And we've seen a lot of union busting going on, especially with Amazon in Staten Island, which luckily they got their union vote. I'm so happy for them. And here at BHM1 in Bessemer, the fight's still on. It's not over yet. Interesting thing is, you know, my husband, who's on strike, went there and basically salted at Amazon since September of last year to try to give his testimony on why, after a year on strike, I can still tell you why we are union strong and what that means.
Yeah, and you still need to support your family in this moment, and it just, that's where you are. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Hayden Wright. Hayden is the UMWA Auxiliary President of Locals 2245 and 2368. Her husband, Braxton, is a control room operator at Warrior Met Coal. He's also a committee man with the UMWA. They've been on, Warrior Met Coal employees have been on strike for over a year. The 1st of April was the 1 year anniversary. And I'm telling you, Hayden, that this is outrageous. And for me, this shows how broken our labor laws are and why, as much of a pro-union president Joe Biden has been, why we need much more, in my view. And I love the fact that Jennifer Abruzzo, the general counsel at the NLRB, is being, you know, more proactive and wanting to use the NLRB in a much more proactive way. But I'm looking at you on strike over here. I'm looking at my friends at in Spectrum in New York City on strike 5 years. Something has to be done in these moments where these corporations dig in and say, you know what? We got deep pockets. We've got all this money. We can outlast you. We can starve your family out until we can make you desperate. Something has to be done.
You're exactly right. And that exact statement has been made by the people negotiating for Warrior Met. They have made that statement that we have the ability to give you everything that you're asking for. We do not have the desire to. We can starve you out. Well, after a year, I can come on here and tell them with 100% certainty that we're not starving and we'll never bend down and kiss the boot of a company that would treat workers that way. So there's that. That we can just go and put that out there. And I think that's one big thing we at the UMWA have been focused on, is bringing attention to how these companies and these private equity groups now are kind of working in conjunction with each other. You have places like BlackRock and Vanguard that swoop in and pretend to save the day when a company seems to be filing for bankruptcy or struggling. And they come in and they bleed the community, the families, and the workers dry. And then there's no accountability for them. The same way BlackRock owns over 13% of the shares for Warrior Met. But yet when we've protested there, when they've made statements, they're like, oh, well, we don't actually get involved with what's going on. That's unacceptable. You should be held accountable. So we actually went to the budget hearing with Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren to talk about how private equity affects workers and the working class. And there are things in place that they would like to see change. The Stop Wall Street Looting Act. But you're not seeing a lot of bipartisan support for it. But things like that could be done to help workers.
Now, this is something that I think is important to point out, that these huge money interests, they organize really well. Capital is well organized. And what they want to make sure is that you and I and working people never organize. And I always use the Jay Gould quote, I can pay half the working class to murder the other half. With their huge sums of money, they spend a lot of time ensuring that you and I are pitted against one another and not standing in solidarity, as we saw yesterday when 3,500 people stood out there with you guys. You said something during the break before we were coming into this segment that grabbed my attention. I said, you know, how are you holding up? And, you know, has this been a rough year? And you said, yeah. It's kind of been a rough year, but I love this about you, always looking to the positive. It's been a beautiful year, you said. Can you go back and say, explain why you think it's been a beautiful year?
Well, I think that it's one thing to be a part of a union and to have those protections, to have your wind garden rights. Those things are important. They're essential to workers. But when push comes to shove and you are on strike, you are being mistreated, to see how quickly your fellow workers and your fellow union siblings and your brothers and sisters will come out and lift you up, not just financially, not just providing physical aid, but to come out to the picket lines, to come out to the rallies, to call you, to text you, to check in, just to send messages of support. And that is a beautiful thing when you can see people, whether they're diehard Republicans and voted for Donald Trump, whether they're hardcore Democrats, whether they're Black Lives Matter, whether they're socialists, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that some are teachers. It doesn't matter that we're minors. It doesn't matter you're a steel worker. We're all able to come together and fight for a common goal that's beneficial for everybody. And that is scary. And I think that's what the mainstream media doesn't want to report on strikes and doesn't want to report on rallies like that. Because when you can see that people can set aside their differences and we realize that, hey, we have a lot more in common than what we've been led to believe. And when we stand together, we can do great things. That is beautiful. And that's scary for a lot of people. Yeah. And especially for capital.
You are absolutely right. So last question I've got for you. How can we help? Clearly, this is, you know, I hope tomorrow Warrior Met wakes up and realizes they're much better off bringing your husband and all of his coworkers back to work and getting the good, you know, highly qualified, highly skilled workers back on the job and paying them what they earn. And what they, you know, sacrificed all these years and making right the promises that Warrior Met made. I hope that happens tomorrow, but I doubt it. And I want to make sure that you're taken care of. How do we help? Is there a way for our listeners to chip in? What should we be doing to help?
Yeah, one thing you do is donate to the International Strike Aid Fund. So if you just type in UMWA Strike Aid Fund, it'll normally pop up for you. And what that does is when it reaches a certain amount, it allows the international to be able to give the members an additional check for $200. And you have to think, when you've been on strike for a year, that $200 makes a big difference in being able to feed your family. It makes a big difference in being able to keep your power on. So that's huge. Another thing you could do is donate to the Auxiliary Strike Pantry. There's a PayPal that you can donate to for that, or you can mail support to the District 20 office. Even if you can't contribute financially, just share the story with someone that might not know. Let them know that, hey, they're in the deep South. They're in Alabama. They have strict right to work laws. They're being thrown up with injunctions, restraining orders. Right now in Montgomery, they're trying to pass an anti-riot bill that would say that the police and the government can say any group of more than five people can be deemed a riot. And it would be a felony. That's an attack on workers. And if they get away with that here in Alabama, your state could be next. So just mailing letters of support to the District 20 office, because they read those at every rally. And do you know how much that means to us to have people? And we've had ones like Walmart workers that have come together and sent $20, but wrote special notes. those notes mean so much. So we're always happy to get those.
No, that's it's important stuff, and we'll make sure we get links out on social media how we can get you guys some help. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts as this continues, and hopefully victory is very near, and you guys stand strong. Hayden, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
Good talking with you. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. This is The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day known as among the darkest days for labor, the Memorial Day Massacre. For days, strikers had suffered arrests and severe beatings at the hands of Chicago police, who physically prevented them from establishing picket lines at South Chicago's Republic Steel. Joined by supporters from practically all walks of life, strikers decided late in the afternoon to march to the gates, determined to picket. For Michael Dennis, author of The Memorial Day Massacre and the Movement for Industrial Democracy, Southeast Chicago became a crucible in which a wide spectrum of social and political alternatives became possible. The Little Steel Strike was propelled by the realization that workers lived in a country dedicated to democratic freedom, but worked under conditions of near autocracy. Men, women, and children, black, white, and Mexican workers all chanted CIO, CIO as they marched down Green Bay Avenue. The Chicago police waited for them, armed with revolvers, nightsticks, and blackjacks. Strikers defended their right to picket as police once again formed a solid line, preventing their passage. The police soon launched tear gas canisters and began firing into the crowd. The picketers turned away in a futile attempt to escape the staggering brutality. When the dust settled, 10 were killed, 30 more shot, 28 others hospitalized, with 8 suffering permanent disability and another 20 to 30 injured. Virtually all those shot had wounds in the back or side. Michael Dennis notes the massacre cast the die for the strike. Collaboration between municipal officials, corporate leaders, and the military in suppressing the strike would go uncontested by federal authorities and cheered by middle-class opinion. The campaign to organize Little Steel had suffered a crushing blow.
Can antibiotic medicines, long hailed as miracle drugs, be too much of a good thing? Yes. Two factors are at work here. First, bacteria, one of the earliest forms of life on Earth, are miracles in their own right, with a stunning ability to outsmart the antibiotic drugs through rapid evolution. Second, is the rather dull inclination of us supposedly superior humans to overuse and misuse antibiotic medicines. Every time we take an antibiotic to kill some bad bacteria that is infecting our bodies, a few of the infectious germs are naturally resistant to the drug, so they survive, multiply, and become a colony of superbugs that antibiotics can't touch. Multiply this colony by the jillions of doses prescribed for everything from deadly staph infections to the common cold, and we get the, quote, antibiotic paradox. The more we use them, the less effective they become, for they're creating a spreading epidemic of immune superbugs. A big cause of this is the push by drug companies to get patients and doctors to reach for antibiotics as a cure-all. For example, millions of doses a year are prescribed for children and adults who have common colds, flu, sore throats, etc. Nearly all of these infections are caused by viruses, which cannot, repeat, cannot be cured with antibiotics. Taking an antibiotic for a cold is as useless as taking a heart drug for heartburn. The antibiotics will do nothing for your cold, but it will help establish drug-resistant superbugs in your body. That's not a smart trade-off. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, it's incomprehensibly stupid. Antibiotics are invaluable medicines we need for serious, life-threatening illnesses, but squandering them on sore throats has already brought us to the brink of superbugs that are resistant to everything. That's the nightmare of all nightmares.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, it's really kind of amazing at how on how our friends on the right react to people pushing back on the bad things they do. And I look at Susan Collins, who evidently Susan Collins wasn't happy that people had the audacity to put chalk on her sidewalk. Evidently, you know, some people have got some colorful chalk. And out in front of her house wrote, Susie, please. Mainers want the WHPA, which is the Women's Health Protection Act. Vote yes, clean up your mess. That seems pretty simple. She called the police. And the Bangor police showed up and said, yeah, it was wonderfully drawn, multiple colors, but they also did not find that it was harassing or in any way threatening. No crime was committed. You know the most offensive part of this whole story? The Department of Public Works for the city of Bangor, Maine, showed up to clean her sidewalk. I find that the most offensive. Just my thoughts. Anyway, we're here to share some thoughts on just how bad things are. Because look, not only did the Department of Public Works come and clean her sidewalk, our Senate moved a piece of legislation to protect the Supreme Court justices who are holding up underground, showing that when they want to do something, oh boy, can they. And quickly, and bipartisanship all right there. Here to share some thoughts on our broken Supreme Court, I've asked our good friend Ian Millhiser to come talk with us. Ian is a senior correspondent over at Vox. He's also the author of the clairvoyant book, The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. Now, this was written a long time ago, and read it, not even bad enough. Ian, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here. Thank you so much.
Let's start with the sidewalk. If someone chalked your sidewalk up, you think you can get the Department of Public Works to come out with a hose and spray off your sidewalk?
Yeah, I mean, if someone chalks my sidewalk, I wait for it to rain. Like, I mean, come on. It's the silliest thing in the world. But like, I think part of the story here is that conservative media has become so effective in pushing whatever alternative narrative Republicans want to push. I mean, how fast after the Roe opinion leaked did the narrative go from, oh my God, the Supreme Court's going to overrule Roe v. Wade, to how dare someone leak it, to how dare, like, maybe 30 people showed up outside of Justice Kavanaugh's house to hold a candle and chant. I mean, maybe I would think that I was so privileged that I could call the police over something like that if I had a multi-billion-dollar media network telling me that the worst thing that could possibly happen is that someone might show up at my house and politely tell me not to do what I am doing.
Yeah, and they even asked, please, Susie, please, please, Mainers want you to protect the WHPA. They want you to vote for it. They said, please. And look, I've been to Maine numerous times. People in Maine are very polite. And it was very well done on top of it. I'm struggling. Now, these are the same people who said that, you know, the couple in Missouri coming out with the guns, that was okay. I guess I'm struggling. I'm struggling. With where we are as a country, Ian.
No, I mean, struggling with where we are as a country is a great, you know, is I think the right place to be. I mean, you know, we're about to lose, or, you know, women are about to lose, you know, an essential human right. And this is going on at a time when the court has been dismantling the Voting Rights Act, you know, when they've been coming up with all sorts of creative ways to strike down maps that favor Democrats and uphold maps that favor Republicans. And, you know, at some point, like, you know, if we're going to have a fight about, if we're going to have a real political fight about abortion, where like lawmakers are fighting with live ammo and anything is on the table, I think that people who support the right to an abortion can win that fight. Like, the polls tell me that they should win that fight,
right?
Because there's, you know, according to some polls, you know, 2/3 or more support for keeping Roe. But you can only win a political fight if you have fair elections. And, you know, what worries me about this is that the court isn't just taking away substantive rights. They have been looking for all of these ways to skew our elections so that, you know, the views of the people matter a whole lot less than they
should. I mean, to me, again, this is another example of just how extreme our court system has gone away from, you know, what we the people want. But, you know, this has been going on for a while. And your book, you know, as I said, you know, clairvoyant. I mean, the reality is you wrote it well before a lot of this craziness happened. But, you know, it wasn't hard to predict. This was the direction that the Mitch McConnells of the world wanted the court to go. in taking away rights from women, in taking away rights from workers, from consumers, taking away rights from citizens. I mean, you think back, you know, we made money speech, we made corporations people, we stripped fundings from unions, we're now going after women, we've screwed over workers with these, you know, these forced arbitration clauses and consumers too. I mean, you know, go down the list of all the bad decisions in the last 20 years, 22 years, go back to 2000 with Sandra Day O'Connor and, you know, oh, we're going to harm George W. Bush by counting the votes. And we got a Supreme Court that's crazy.
Right. Yeah. And we've got a court that I think, you know, it would be one thing if we got this court through a fair and democratic process. You know, like the thing that strikes me most about this moment is we have the first justice in American history to be nominated by a president who lost the popular vote and be confirmed by a block of senators who represent less than half the country was Neil Gorsuch, you know, Trump's first appointee. The second was his second appointee, Brett Kavanaugh. The third was his third appointee, Amy Coney Barrett. You know, the reason why Congress, you know, there's supposed to be a vote in the Senate soon on the Women's Health Protection Act, which is the bill to codify abortion rights. It's going to get 49 Democratic votes. It's going to go down 49-51. But those 49 senators represent something like 40 million more people than the 51 senators who are going to vote against it. So, like, I think these are fights that, like, that my team can win. You know, the team that supports abortion rights, the team that supports democracy. I think these are fights that we can win in a fair fight. But, like, I just wish we were having a fair fight right now.
Yeah, and this is where, you know, look, on a certain level, you have to give the McConnells and the conservative think tank movement and all of them the credit that they had a game plan. They followed through. They invested in it and they followed through. And we were the dupes who, well, didn't fight back at it enough.
Yeah. And what I hope doesn't happen, I mean, here I am, like, giving this gloom and doom story about how, like, the system is rigged. But what I hope doesn't happen is that, like, that people do not fall into despair. I think it is easy to say, like, it's not fair that I've got to play on this unlevel playing field and that, you know, that I've got so many things lined up against me. I mean, first of all, if anyone's tried to unionize their employer, that's like what every unionization drive looks like is, you know, you've got every obstacle in front of you. And the only way that you get there is you say, well, I'm going to push through them. And I think that people have to have a similar attitude here. You know, you can win a fight, you can win a game when you've got to run uphill. You got to play harder than the other team.
Yep.
But, you know, the stakes are just so enormous that I hope that everyone understands, like, this next election is going to be crucial. And, you know, there isn't a path. I mean, we know that, you know, if you care about abortion rights, there are only 49 Democrats. There's only 49 votes in the Senate for the abortion rights bill. 49 isn't enough. But there's going to be an election. And if after that election there are 54 votes for it, you know, that is probably enough. That's probably enough to nuke the filibuster and move forward. So, you know, there's a certain amount of just like running in the face of pain that everyone's got to do right now. If there's going to be any ability to solve this problem.
No, you've got to put up a fight. And this is what I've been saying for a very long time. This is where I've been very critical of Democrats on a whole host of issues that I don't see the urgency on, you know, name the issue that I would hope to see. And look, this, I don't see the urgency on this issue either that I thought I would see. Look, people have been outraged and there's, you know, Twitter's been all lit up and all this stuff. But look, things should be stopping. There should be nothing going on in the Senate at this moment other than talking about ensuring that people have the right to self-determination. Families should have the right to privacy. Because look, they're... Listen to Marsha Blackburn. Listen to Mike Braun. Listen to what the other side is saying. They're not just going to stop with Roe. They're going to go after all of the other decisions. And, you know, you and I have talked about this for years, where the ultimate goal is to take us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s.
Yeah. No. And I mean, I think it's there's a lot of big fights coming. I mean, there's, you know, first of all, if you read the draft opinion from Alito that was leaked, his reasoning in that opinion is identical to the reasoning in his Obergefell dissent, the marriage equality case. You know, in both cases, what he said is that, like, the only rights that aren't specifically mentioned in the Constitution that are protected are rights that are grounded in history and tradition. And he claims that neither abortion nor the right to marry a person of the same sex are grounded grounded in history and tradition. And so, like, I mean, I don't know if Alito has the votes yet, but I know where he wants to go next. You know, I know that in the Hobby Lobby case, you know, your definition of what constitutes an abortion and my definition of what constitutes an abortion is not the same as, like, the definition that a lot of people have. You know, in the Hobby Lobby case, we thought of that as a contraception case. It was about employers who didn't want to provide contraception in their, when their employer provided health plans. But the reason why the employers in that case said they didn't want to do it is because they thought that, like, many forms of birth control are in fact forms of abortion. You know, they, I can get into the science there, but I'm not a doctor. So, like, I don't want to be like Sam Alito and opine on women's health when I don't know enough about it. But, like, you know, that's what they believe. And so if you believe that an IUD is abortion and the court says that you can now ban abortions, you know, what do you think that lawmaker is going to do? You know, if you believe that birth control pills are an abortion and this court says you can ban abortion, you're going to try to ban birth control pills. And so I think that there's a lot of fights coming that, like, I mean, not just that I didn't think we'd have to have in this country. I didn't think that any developed country would have to have them in the 21st century.
Yeah, but here again, you talk to some of these people, and they want to take us back to those moments. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Ian Millhiser. Ian's a senior correspondent over at Vox. He's also the author of the book, The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. We'll get links out on social media. You can pick up a copy of that. Well worth the read. And one of those things where, had you read it a couple years back, maybe 10, you'd have gone, no, we're not going here. Well, we're here, and worse. But, you know, Ian, this is in talking about the leaked memo, and there are a lot of people who are going, you know, who could have done it? It was the liberals who did it. No, it was the conservatives who did it. I have people, and I happen to believe it was probably, you know, a certain Supreme Court justice's wife, possibly has a history of doing that in the past. I'm told. Does it matter who leaked it, do you think?
I mean, it's interesting who leaked it. I mean, it says something about court's intrigue. It says something about, like, if it was a liberal clerk, to what extent liberals are losing faith with the court. If it was a conservative clerk, it says something about, like, how, like, greedy the conservatives are to get everything that they can have and get it now. But, like, ultimately, like, everything is a sideshow compared to what that opinion actually says. I mean, I think it is interesting that the court has sprung a leak. I would like to know who the leaker is. Like, yeah, I mean, everyone loves palace intrigue. It's fun. But in this case, the palace intrigue is about people losing a basic human right. And so, you know, again, I want to know who the leaker is, but I just want to make sure that we understand that all of this, you know, are people protesting in front of someone's house? Does Susan Collins have chalk on her sidewalk? All of that is secondary to the question of whether or not the right to an abortion is still going to exist.
And now the question becomes, because, you know, as I was, you know, talking about the Susan Collins thing, and as, you know, yesterday we were talking about, you know, Alito and, you know, having to go underground into the secret bunker, and now you've got the bipartisan, you know, a secret police act for Supreme Court justices, or whatever they're calling that. My thoughts come back to, when do we start outlawing the ability to redress our government for grievances? When do we stop being able to protest in public? When does that begin to happen? Because, again, you know, a lot of people look at this abortion issue and go, I'm past my childbearing years, which, me as a 55-year-old white guy, I am well past my childbearing years. So it doesn't really matter to me personally. Now, I've got two daughters. Matters very much what their lives could be, their ability to determine the course of their existence. So it means something to me in that vein. But I think a lot of people, maybe not as urgent. But I come back to this point of, you know, this is just the beginning. This is going to get a lot worse, I think, because, well, these folks have a religious kind of bent, this kind of zealotry that I don't think this country really understands.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've covered the Federalist Society for, you know, maybe a decade now, you know, the conservative group that picked all of Trump's judges, or many of Trump's judges, and all of his justices, I believe. And, like, the thing that strikes me, like the first time I covered a Federalist Society event, like I felt like I was in a room with a bunch of medieval viscounts, like, you know, people who, like, you know, felt a certain entitlement to rule. And this was during the Obama administration. And, you know, there was just this overarching sense that, like, this guy in the White House wasn't legitimate because he's not the guy who's supposed to rule. We're the guys who are supposed to rule. And I mean, they can be very polite. They can be very genteel. They, like, they're often very, very smart people who can construct very, very well put together legal arguments, and, like, arguing against them is a daunting task. But fundamentally, I mean, you know, I felt the same energy that I would have felt in a room of, like, literal aristocrats. This sense that, like, you know, something has somehow gone wrong if they're not in charge. And, you know, if you think that way and you control an institution that literally has the power to veto any law and to rewrite any other law, then, you know, I mean, that is probably not going to end well for people who care about democracy.
No, and, you know, one of the things that gets me is I have a lot of my friends who voted for Trump and vote for Republicans because they believe, and this is the weird part of this, and this is the kind of strange place we are in this country in, that they believe that the Republicans are taking on the kind of elitism and the kind of aristocrats that you've laid out, that they believe that they're fighting against those folks, not actually being them.
No, I mean, I think the Republican Party has done a good job of, like, I mean, this is one reason why I think that they do so much governance by judiciary, because, like, you know, so, like, I have a whole chapter in my book about this, about forced arbitration, how, like, your boss, or, like, really any company you do business with, your cell phone company, your bank, or whatever, can force you to sign away your right to sue them. And, like, instead go to this private arbiter who, like, often is rigged in favor of the corporation. And, like, there's no constituency for that. Like, Republicans couldn't get a bill through Congress that enacts that kind of a regime. But if you do it on the Supreme Court, no one notices. Like, I talk about this. People a lot of times be like, well, what are you talking about? Like, that sounds like, why haven't I heard about that? And the reason why is because, like, the court operates in closed doors. It hands down, like, 60-page essays that are full of legalese that, you know, unless you're a lawyer, it's often hard to understand what they say. And you know, and you have to, like, be a particular kind of lawyer who knows that subject matter to know what the implications are. And so Donald Trump can, like, you know, get out there and do photo ops where he's sitting at a big rig or where he's, you know, walking through a factory, and he can, like, have a certain kind of personal charisma that, you know, that appeals to people who are afraid of, you know, elites, you know, taking over their lives. But then he puts Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. He puts Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. I mean, Neil Gorsuch is, like, I believe his mother was a cabinet, was a member of Ronald Reagan's cabinet. And I believe he is the heir to, like, a ski wear fortune. Like, if you want an elite, there's an elite. You know, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh both went to the same elite all boys prep school in Washington, D.C. You know, Amy Coney Barrett's father was a oil and gas attorney in Louisiana. Like, I mean, if you don't like being governed by elites, you know, I would think that the heir to a ski wear fortune is probably not. It's probably not the kind of person you want to be governed by.
Yeah. Last line of questioning I got for you, because, you know, the court, I've got a bunch of friends are going, this is why we need to add justices to the court. Like Biden can just snap his fingers and that'll happen, especially given how broken our Senate is. Is there a way forward outside of the elections? Because, look, I keep saying, look, you got to vote. While we still have the ability to vote, we've still out-procreated their money. We've, for the time being, still have the ability to vote. Go do it. Make sure you're registered. Make sure you know where your polling place is. Make sure you plan to get there. Make sure you get there on the right days. Do that so we get more people in to overturn some of this horrible. But is it possible to go and add justices, or is that a pipe dream?
I mean, it is possible. So the Constitution says there shall be a Supreme Court. It does not say how many people will sit on the Supreme Court. That is entirely up to Congress. I think the first Supreme Court had 6 members. I think it has gone as low as 5, and it has gone as high as 10. And so, you know, all that it takes is a simple act of Congress, you know, majority of the House, majority of the Senate, president's signature, and we could have 13 or 15 seats, and then President Biden could fill all of them. But if you want that to happen, and I mean, like, after the Roe opinion leak, there's actually a poll which showed that a plurality of Americans do want that to happen. You know, there are not the votes in Congress for that right now. There are not the votes in Congress for the Women's Health Protection Act, which is the, you know, abortion rights bill right now. And so you can give up, or you can say, well, we need more votes, so let's go out and elect the people we need so we have enough votes. I would not let the fact, I mean, this is the problem that literally anyone who has ever done politics ever has had, is that when you don't have the votes to get the outcome you want, you got to go win some elections, and then you have the votes. I mean, this isn't a new problem. It's just that the stakes are very high right now.
No, this is that moment. But Ian, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Keep up the great work over there at Vox, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
All right. Thanks a bunch, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend Ian Millhiser, he's a senior correspondent there at Vox. Make sure you check out his work. We'll get links out. Also, his book, The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. Highly suggest that. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. If you're just joining us, make sure you grab the podcast. Never miss an episode. Make sure you subscribe, share, like, all of that stuff. Back after this. Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, the more I listen to Ian, the more concerned I get about the direction that we're going in this country. When you look at this Supreme Court, it's really frightening to think that we're heading back to the bad old days of the 80s and 90s. And as I've said, not the 1980s and 90s. Talking about the 1880s, 1890s, the era of the Gilded Age, the era of the robber baron, and even, you know, probably further back than that. I mean, when you're talking about going back to a time where you had, you know, two classes of people, the people who had and then everybody else. And working people have historically been the ones who have been everybody else. Those people, you know, struggling, and, you know, life being short and brutish. And I think back to, you know, the stories of my grandparents and the fights that they talked about in attempting to build the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And they did it by taking to the streets. They did it by standing together. They did it by demanding better. But they also did it through politics. They also did it through the demanding the courts make change. The changes we're seeing right now are all in the wrong direction. The changes we're seeing now are all about taking rights away, about destroying life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, about consolidating power back into the hands of a few, the moneyed few. And this should be concerning to everyone. It's concerning to me, and it's one of these moments where the more this pendulum swings to the moneyed side, the corporate side, the more we see these decisions happening, the more we see this stuff coming down the road, the worse it's getting. And we're doing some of this to ourselves. I mean, I look at, you know, this, you know, over the past week, you know, seeing, you know, Elon Musk, you know, putting out his poll, who do you trust more? billionaires or politicians. And overwhelmingly, you know, working people are saying, now again, this is Twitter, and I don't know how much weight you put into that poll, but overwhelmingly, the people on Twitter say, no, no, we trust our billionaires, our beloved billionaires. And yet, you know, this idea that we were sold that if we created this billionaire class and we gave them, you know, everything they could want, that somehow this was going to trickle down and somehow we would do better, just hasn't really played out the way we were told.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media